From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, as the federal government shutdown stretches into day 21, furloughed workers are missing their first paychecks.
I feel terrible. I feel anxious, depressed. I you know, I wake up in the morning, I don't know what to do. I check my email and hope that I've got a message that says come to work today. And hasn't happened yet.
Are we any closer to a compromise? We break it down on our weekend review. Also today, the New England Aquarium's new chief executive tells us what's on her agenda and how the aquarium is taking on climate change.
Wanting to be a scientist, that was never the end game. It was a means to better understanding something so that I could change it.
And the Los Angeles Chargers take on the Patriots Sunday with revenge on their minds.
Is it special to go to New England against the Hall of Fame coach and arguably the best quarterback ever to play and get another shot at him? Heck yeah. Heck yeah, it is.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday, so time for our week in review. As the federal government shutdown stretches into day 21, furloughed federal workers and some essential workers still on the job are missing their first paychecks. At a rally in Boston today, furloughed workers like Kevin Elliott vented their frustration about the stalemate.
The wall thing, I just don't understand how that's holding up everyone getting paid. It feels like people are being held hostage over politics.
Senator Ed Markey condemned President Trump, saying the president is harming families.
The president is using ordinary families of federal workers as pawns, as hostages in a larger game for a border wall, which every security expert says will not work.
But during his visit to the border, President Trump blamed the gridlock on congressional Democrats who refused to fund his border wall.
The government shut down because Democrats will not fund border security, plain and simple. And again, more than just the walls. Their open borders agenda threatened all American families.
So, can a deal be reached to end this shutdown? Well, joining me now is Joe Battenfeld. He's a columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Hello, Joe.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Marie St. Fleur. She's a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Hi there, Marie.
It's good to be here.
Hello. So, Joe, this partial shutdown will almost certainly become the longest in U.S. history tomorrow,
right,
longer than the 21-day shutdown of 1995. How much longer do you see this dragging on?
I see it could go on weeks, months, even, the way it's going right now. I mean, depending on what the president decides to do with his emergency declaration powers. But if he decides not to do that or decides not to link it somehow to the shutdown, then there seems to be no end in sight. I mean, you look at both sides. Did you see any room for compromise anywhere the other night when they both gave their speeches? It was ridiculous. Both sides were so far apart. There was no room for compromise anywhere. So I don't think either side has left itself any wiggle room at all.
Well, to that point, Maine Senator Susan Collins told NPR today that it's very difficult when we're dealing with people who do not want to budge at all in their positions, right? So we heard House Speaker Nancy Pelosi say recently that the wall is an immorality. That would seem to leave little room for compromise. The president, Marie, seems willing to maybe change the materials, you know, maybe build out of steel instead of concrete, but really not budge on the wall. So do you have any more optimistic forecasts than Joe? Or do you also see this stretching on for a long time to come?
I see this stretching on unless, of course, the Senate decides that it's a co-equal branch of government and decide to do exactly what pass the bills that they had already agreed on with bipartisan support and marshal its members to be ready to overcome the president's vetoes. And I think at the end of the day, the Congress will begin to feel this as well. So somebody needs to step up, and I don't see the president moving.
So the president has flipped here. I remember at the outset he said that he would be proud to shut down the government.
Yes.
He said he would take ownership of it. He's changed his mind, of course, and now he's blaming Democrats. But does he have a point, Marie? I mean, couldn't the Democrats just throw him his $5.7 billion? It's a drop in the bucket of a $4 trillion federal budget. Just give him his wall and maybe buy, you know, a path to citizenship for Dreamers.
But the reality is, one, it's a false argument that the president is raising. All the data shows that really continuing to build a wall is not a solution to solving the issues of immigration in this country. We also know from all the data that there are other ways. I mean, the world has advanced besides a wall. There's all sorts of technology. There's sorts of surveillance, diversion that works in order to that have continued to work and have been working effectively to reduce illegal immigration at the borders. And so to give him, almost $6 billion to spend on a make-believe wall is not the best way to spend our tax dollars. Moreover, they did give him some money, and I don't recall the exact dollar amount, but he's been given a few billion dollars already to work on that wall, and he didn't spend that money on the wall. So we know that he just wants money to play, Monopoly. He wants Monopoly money to play, not really to solve the problems that face the people of this country, which is really they need to buckle down and provide this country a clear pathway good immigration policies in order to for us to be able to move forward.
Yeah, the president wouldn't sign that initial spending bill pass in the Senate that would
have had
some funding, but not as much as he wanted. Joe, is there a compromise here, though, maybe to get the government back open? The president's been talking all week about the possibility of using emergency powers to build the wall. I mean, could that be sort of a workaround? You open the government
back up?
That
could be an out for him. It could be an out for him because he could just declare, okay, I'm going to do this on my own and apply this emergency money to the border wall and then say, okay, and then release the money to keep the government running. He could do that. And in fact, I think that would be best for him politically to do that because in that way he can say, okay, I at least gave a little. I reopened the government. I put these people back and gave these people their paychecks back and blame Democrats for not moving on it at all. And then, of course, it's going to get held up in the courts, whatever he decides to do with his emergency declaration money. But then he can just say, oh, the liberal courts are holding me up. So I think there is a political way out for him of this. And I do think it's the fault of both sides that there has been no agreement on this. Democrats are doing this because it's politically expedient for them to say all of a sudden the wall is immorality when in fact people like Chuck Schumer have approved money before for a border fence or wall, whatever you want to call it. So I think both sides could move on this, and they're just not because it's politically expedient for them to do otherwise.
So if the president were to exert his emergency powers, what exactly would that look like? Well, NPR is reporting today that one option on the table would be using money from the Army Corps of Engineers, perhaps to divert money from existing projects, things that perhaps could be put on hold. Not disaster relief, but that's something that could hit us here. You know, Massachusetts has 10 Army Corps of Engineer offices around the state. And we spoke with Congressman Joe Kennedy earlier this week about the prospect of an emergency. He told Radio Boston that such a move would be an unprecedented power grab.
He probably has the authority to do it. Does that mean it will withstand legal scrutiny? No, it doesn't, and that is very much up in the air. And certainly, even if he might have the legal authority to do it, should he do it? The answer to that is absolutely not.
And just one update on that. The president, just in the last moments, has said that he is not going to declare a state of emergency immediately, but he's hoping that perhaps Congress will do its job. Joe, what do you see there? I mean, the president seems to be a little bit stuck because even if he does get his wall one way or the other, it doesn't sound like Mexico is paying for it, and it's not coming as quickly as he promised. Do you think he can still satisfy his base if he gets it anyway?
I do think he can satisfy his base. If he delivers the money for it, I think people, delivers the wall in any way, shape, or form, whatever you want to call it, a steel or fence or whatever you want to call it, some form of a wall is what his supporters want. And I think that's what he promised them. Of course, the whole Mexico thing is out the window. Getting Mexico to pay for it is out the window. But I think if there is some form of a wall, I think people will be appeased by that.
And to your point, in an NPR Ipsos poll this week, 2/3 of Republicans did say that the president's speech on Tuesday night helped convince them there is, in fact, a crisis at the border and a need for the wall. So that's only a slice of Republicans, and that's not the whole public, but that is the base that perhaps he's speaking to.
Exactly.
Marie, let's talk a little bit about the human toll here, because just yesterday on Radio Boston, we had Mike Gazagian in. He's a TSA officer at Boston Logan Airport. He's also the acting president of Local 2617 of the American Federation of Government Employees. And he made this comparison about the government shutdown.
if this were, let's say, a public company where the board of directors and the CEO get into a fight over what kind of security system to put in their buildings, and they shut down their business and, you know, laid off all their workers, the shareholders would not accept that. Shareholders would throw them out right away. And this is kind of a similar situation here. So we really have to get the public involved, and, you know, they have to step up and say, you know what, we're not gonna tolerate this. This is ridiculous.
So how about that, Marie? It seems an apt comparison. This is the businessman president, after all.
Well, he's the businessman president, but the reality is the government is not a business. And I know we'd like to make those comparisons, but unlike the private company that can actually lay off its people and disperse them everywhere, unfortunately, if you are working for the federal government and you're an essential employee, you are required to work. You can't, there is not just this idea that you can just go home and sit or go find another job. You are required to show up. TSA is required to show up. Border security is required to show up. A lot of our emergency supports are required to show up. So it is not the same. And unfortunately, you know, there's two ways of looking at this shutdown. He is holding his base. Yes, this is red meat for the base. The 30% that loves him no matter what he does, he's right. And that is the president of the United States, right? He's right. He's using the he doesn't care that he's using the federal employees as a pawn in this game that he's playing, because in his mind, the federal employees are all Democrats. So it's okay, as long as he essentially says, you know, that's who they are. So that's okay. But there's something a little specious about this whole argument that this president raises. What is that wall? What is the symbol of that wall? It really talks about the fact that the people who are on the other side of the wall, the folks who he sees as the other, that he really is throwing meat at to really sow dissension, continually to sow dissension in this country. And that is what that wall represents. It is that structural barrier that speaks about the other. And this is his way of keeping his base captivated at no matter what the cost is. And I think the Democratic Party and the independents and all others who really care about the direction of this country need to stand up and essentially tell Congress, particularly the Senate, step up, do your job, vote. You're getting paid every week, unless, like other Americans, the other folks who are federal employees, you're still able to take care of yourselves. Regular American families cannot put food on their table now. They can't get health care to take care of themselves, and they can't really survive. So we need to really ask Congress. I think it's really about the House and the Senate sitting down, working out a deal, getting the right votes. Each of them can count. You know, Mitch McConnell knows how to count and get his members to step up and be ready to override any vote. We don't need a wall that's going to essentially cost you $28 billion. $6 billion is just a down payment, all right? What could $6 billion do for kids in school, for health care, for early education and care? You're talking about a wall that's essentially going to cost you almost, for maintenance, the first decade will cost you, I want to say, somewhere around $48 billion. What could we do with our infrastructure with $48 billion to support our own programs, policies, roads and bridges in states across this country? And excuse me, he wants to tell the Corps of Engineers to figure out where they're going to find the money. We have our infrastructure across this country is falling apart. And you want to take money from the little bit of money that we have in order to put toward a wall that every expert tells you does not make any sense. So again, we have to ask the co-equal branch of government to step up, represent all of us, and get us moving.
Well, if it does come to the Army Corps of Engineers, no doubt there'll be a lot of scrutiny of which projects the money is being diverted away from. So something for us to keep an eye on. But you mentioned education funding in there, Marie, and I do want to get to that point. On the state level, in local news this week, we had Boston's Mayor Marty Walsh signaling his support for a reform for the way the state doles out education money to cities. He was on Radio Boston earlier this week, and this is what he said about it.
Something has to be done here. This is something that's drastic. It's about the future of our young people. And working off a formula that's 26 years old just doesn't work anymore.
Now, the mayor is getting behind a bill filed by State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz. She's trying, yet again, to increase funding for public schools.
Every year that we fail to get this done, We are accepting another class of economically disadvantaged children graduating through our system without access to arts programming or computer science or foreign language classes or a soccer team or a school psychologist.
Governor Baker is expected to file an education bill of his own in the coming weeks. He also says the formula used to calculate how much state aid a city receives needs to be updated. So, Joe, there may be different strategies here, but there does seem to be some bipartisan agreement that this education funding formula is outdated. And I'll just try to summarize it quickly for us so we understand. In short, it calculates a city's need for state aid by looking at how much tax revenue the city collects. Boston collects a lot of tax revenue, so the formula thinks Boston doesn't need very much aid. The mayor's complaining about that, and he's saying that we need to get more money out of this formula. Does he have a point?
Boston does need more money from this, definitely. I think the mayor has a point. He's coming to it a little bit late in the game, I think. But I think because the legislature has been, Democrats in the legislature have been leading on this. But I do think that there are going to be different strategies on how you get the funding. It's not going to be just everybody agreeing and nicely and saying, okay, we got to deliver more money. Governor Baker is going to demand that other reforms get tied to this money. And so there's not just giving money without any strings attached to it. He's going to demand some strings attached to it. And I think that the Democrats in the legislature are going to resist that. So I think we are going to have some problems. It's not just going to be an easy passage.
I think when you say he's late to the game, you may be referring to the fact that Sonia Chang Diaz had a similar bill like this
exactly.
In the last session, which he sort of sat out.
Right.
When he was on our air this week, of course, he's looking out for Boston in particular, but he argued that the education bill would be a positive thing for the entire state.
It's not just Boston. This is many cities and towns across Massachusetts. Ultimately, this bill lifts all cities and towns for education funding. It's something that is desperately needed.
So, Joe, what do you hear when you say Mayor Walsh? I hear Mayor Walsh say that. Is he broadening the appeal of his argument or broadening his own appeal?
Well, I think he has taken steps clearly recently to broaden his appeal statewide. Whatever that means, running for Senate maybe in the future, maybe running for governor in the future, he's definitely taken some steps to broaden his appeal. So it certainly benefits the Democrats in the legislature by him getting on board, it also benefits him as well.
And Marie, if the mayor is behind this version of the bill, is that a difference maker? Because Sonia Chang Diaz's bill in the last legislative session got through one chamber but not through the other, and it lacked the support of the mayor and the governor. So is having Walsh on her team this time going to be enough to push over the finish line?
I mean, I think it's always good to have the mayor of Boston on your team when you're trying to move a piece of legislation, particularly in the issue of advocacy and elevating the issue. I think it's really important. Though I do want to say, in his defense, having served with the mayor when he was in the legislature, that this is not an issue he is new to, and those are issues that he voted on as a legislator from Dorchester, that those are issues that he championed. And I also, having worked in the mayor's office, not under his leadership, but we understand that each mayor sets an agenda, and there was an early education and care agenda that he had set that year that he is trying to push through that actually he did not get any traction on, and we know that it's really important that we invest in children earlier. Apparently filed, and I have not seen it, a new legislative package, and that is part of that legislative package that he has filed. All that being said, I'm glad that he's on it. The issue of increased funding for education is critical, and I'm glad the mayor is on board, and other mayors have to be on board as well. The Mass Education Partnership have been talking about this for a long time now, because we've talked about Massachusetts is number one for some. So it's not simply an issue for Boston. When you disaggregate the numbers and look at it, we're always talking about how well Massachusetts is doing in education. But when you really disaggregate the numbers and really get down to it, there's certain populations in Massachusetts where children are not doing well at all. And we really need to figure out where we invest equitable investment that would allow these students to get to the starting line in order to have a chance. And so, yes, I believe it has to be accountability. If you're going to put more money, you have to make it more accountable. But if we're going to talk about accountability, we need to figure out how that's really going to reflect in the classroom, where the kids sit, where it will have the most impact. So I'm glad everybody's looking at the issue of education. Increased funding, Chapter 70 is outdated, and it is time for it to be revamped, but we need to make certain that it is revamped within the context of equitable access to a quality education in Massachusetts for all children.
Just to put a figure on it, you say we got to spend more on education. This latest version of the bill could cost $1.5 billion. Here's another figure that really stood out to me this week, although perhaps it shouldn't have surprised any of us. There are only 16 female firefighters in the entire city of Boston on a force of 1,500. We got that figure from a new city-commissioned report that identifies what it calls a male-dominated culture within the fire department with widespread, quote, locker room talk, familiar phrase from the president there. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh says the city needs to recruit more women to the force. He spoke about it with CBS Boston.
Ultimately, it comes down to really creating more opportunities. I mean, when you think of a fire department that has, you know, 1,500 firefighters, 16 women, it makes it really difficult, challenging. I mean, I don't care what environment you live in or work in. That's a big number. That's a big difference.
Some, including Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell, tell Boston Radio that recruitment efforts are not enough.
But if we really want these departments to be reflective of our current demographics, it cannot just be a couple of initiatives. It has to be comprehensive, and we have to look at civil service.
Now, Marie, the Boston Fire Commissioner Joseph Flynn says his department is making progress toward diversifying. The incoming class of 54 recruits includes 20 racial minorities. That's more than a third. It's the most since 2003. But there's still just one woman out of those 54. Can there be real change in the firehouses without more women in the ranks?
You know, incremental change, right? I mean, this is not the first time that the fire department has been in the news or the issues of diversity or of inclusion have come up. It's not simply under Mayor Walsh. It predates, right? And so to some extent, we do have to look at all the tools in the box. So the idea that we continue to work on recruitment, I think that's great. I think that's one tool in the box. But we have to take a look at all of this. I always have to say, you know, we have a system. Things just don't happen by accident. We created a system that has allowed for this lack of diversity, lack of inclusion of women to happen. And so we need to go back and take a look at the structures that are currently in place, and civil service is one of them. You know, we shouldn't get it. Everybody gets really personal about this. Sometimes we have vehicles that exist that we either by just benignly or actively causes some of the problems that we are experiencing. And if we are going to be honest about solving the problem, we have to look at all of it and really do a fair assessment. Civil service was not something that sort of Moses came down from the mountains and landed and said, okay, thou shalt have civil service. Somebody thought that there was a problem and made civil service the tool in order to correct the problem. Now we're saying that it has had a disparate impact in some populations. And so the question is not about getting rid. It's really looking at it, analyzing it. Councilor Campbell is not the first one to raise that issue. That whole issue has been looked at as it relates to the police department. I think if we go back and take a look at old cases, we'll find that this issue has elevated itself. So let's stop talking about it. Take a deep dive. Let's do the analysis and figure out whether or not there's any there. If there is, let's do something about it. If there's not, let's figure out another solution. But again, 16 out of 1,500? Come on. I mean, it speaks for itself.
But changing the civil service exam system can be tricky, though, right, Joe? Because you've got a lot of people who score highly, they achieve highly, and the way we structure it right now, there's a preference given to veterans, which has some merit on its own. But of course, that is a very heavily male pool. So by changing it, creating one new problem to fix another one?
In fact, the whole civil service system was put in place to get politics out of it, because mayors were abusing it, so they put it in place so the patronage wouldn't exist. So there are noble reasons, actually, for civil service for why it was put in place. And I don't think you can just scrap it. But I do think it certainly can be looked at, and certainly there are too few women on the firefighting force. Those numbers are incredibly low and should be higher. And in fact, they are doing a better job of recruiting minorities to the police department and the fire department. But I think more could be done there as well, because, in fact, Boston is now a majority minority city. And, you know, a third is not enough. A third racial minorities is not enough. They need to be making a better recruitment effort, I think, especially with women.
All right, let's try to squeeze in our hubbubs. These are the brief stories or events that caught our attention this week and deserve a shout out. Joe, what do you have on your mind this week?
Well, the next time you have a penny in your, you know, somebody gives you a penny and you just stick it in your pocket, you might want to check that penny, because a Pittsfield man who had a penny he'd been keeping since 1947 sold at an auction this week for $200,000. It was an all bronze penny, and apparently they didn't make very many of them. $200,000 for a penny. I'd say that's a good return on your investment. Unfortunately, the man died last year and was not able to cash in on it, but he did make sure that the money was donated to the local library. So I think next time you get a penny, and you might want to check it.
That's quite a windfall, though. Perhaps not the most reliable retirement plan. Marie, what's your hubbub for the week?
Mine is an invitation. King Boston and the Boston Foundation are sponsoring a teach-in on economic justice on the occasion of the 90th birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. That is happening at the Arlington Street Church. It starts at 3 p.m. We want everyone to come down if you're really concerned about closing the income gap, if you're concerned about economic justice and really want to have a conversation about what our city will look like in the next 15 to 20 years. Great time to have a conversation with Professors Tommy Shelby and Brandon Terry from Harvard University, who are scholars of Dr. King, and we are delighted that Paul English has created the space for us to be able to have this conversation and also to drive the creation of a memorial honoring Coretta Scott King and Dr. Martin Luther King on our wonderful Boston Common.
All right. Thanks for the invitation, Marie, and thank you for being here. That's Marie St. Flour, a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Flour Communications.
Thank you.
And Joe Battenfeld, political columnist for the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Yet another ominous report on climate change this week. Ocean temperatures are rising 40% faster than a UN panel estimated just 5 years ago. And few research institutions are as dialed into what's happening in our warming oceans as Boston's own New England Aquarium, where 1.4 million visitors go each year. Vicki Spruill is president and CEO of the New England Aquarium, and she joins me now in studio. Vicki, welcome to Radio Boston.
I'm glad to be here.
So you've been in the role for 4 months. You're still newish to this.
Yeah.
Your predecessor was a biologist. You come from a different background, from the nonprofit world. So what's the transition been like for you?
First of all, I have to say Boston has been a wonderfully welcoming city, so don't believe all the things you hear
That's
about.
That's not our reputation.
Yeah, no, it isn't, but that has absolutely not been my experience. Part of what attracted me to this role was to be able to build on this rich history this institution has for science and research, this amazing ability it has to inspire and educate people, and to those 1.4 million visitors a year, but then to really build on that platform around advocacy and conservation. And I think the data you just suggested is the absolute reason why. We have to use the platform and the voice we have to talk about what's really happening in the ocean.
Is that sort of what's on your agenda? I mean, the New England Aquarium is such a familiar institution to so many Bostonians, coming up on 50 years, in fact, next year. So so what is on your agenda, maybe short term and long term?
So I think really enhancing our place in the city and regionally and nationally as a conservation organization. There are very few institutions that can combine research, science, education, and conservation and policy advocacy all under one roof that are as beloved and as iconic and as trusted a messenger of these issues as we are. So really repositioning us in that light is foremost on my agenda, and again, using our platform and our voice to speak out on so many of these issues. You mentioned climate change, you know, and we are 50 years old, and that means that we've been doing data and research and collecting data in the Gulf of Maine, which is warming 99% faster than other parts of the Atlantic. So essentially, we've been doing climate adaptation research for 50 years. And so we need to use that data to better inform the public about what's actually happening and what we can do about it.
I know that one of the policy points on which the aquarium has taken a stand recently is in opposition to the Trump administration's decision to allow seismic blasting up and down the Atlantic coast to search for lucrative oil and gas deposits, right? And conservationists and researchers, including those at the aquarium, have really taken this as a call to arms because the blasts are so loud that they can injure, deafen, and ultimately threaten the survival of endangered populations like the North Atlantic right whale. There's only 450 of them left. So I'm wondering why the aquarium has taken it upon itself to venture into this advocacy role as opposed to just being sort of a museum for people to go and see species.
I just think that's not enough anymore. I think the public, and we're seeing this in all kinds of visitor data, they expect more. I don't know if this is good news or bad news, but I think the public is more informed about what some of these issues are. These conversations around plastic and even climate change are far more mainstream than, say, they were, you know, certainly even 5 or 10 years ago or so. And so I feel like we have an obligation to take on this more active voice. In fact, last night we hosted to a packed house in our IMAX theater a discussion about stopping offshore oil and gas drilling. And it was a really engaged, wonderful conversation, free to the public. And so, you know, I don't think there are many places that could attract that kind of crowd on a Thursday night.
And you mentioned the plastics. I do want to point out that President Trump in October did sign the Save Our Seas Act, which is at least designed to help keep plastic and trash out of the ocean. So I'm curious whether, is it sort of a case-by-case basis for the aquarium, not being opposed to the Trump administration's agenda wholesale, but just looking at every single piece? Can you partner with him on something like that?
Of course we could. This is not about, this is issue by issue, and we have to look at what are the impacts to the ocean and what are the impacts to the animals that we are working to protect and conserve. And so, you know, there is so much complexity about what's happening in the ocean that this is very much an issue-by-issue situation.
But do you worry at all about the aquarium being viewed as too political, you know, turning off some visitors who say, oh, they're really, you know, getting into a cause one way or the other, they're taking sides. I don't want to be visiting that or patronizing that.
I think that's a balance that any institution has to always consider. And, you know, science itself, you could make that case that we're already doing that by the kinds of science we're pursuing. So I think you have to thread that needle, no doubt. But I have certainly throughout my career sort of, I think, pride myself on having been able to walk that line.
So one other policy point I want to ask you about. A few years ago, the New England Aquarium worked with the previous administration to create the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts National Marine Monument, which is the first of its kind. And like any other national monument where it's protected as a sort of oasis, you know, there is this protection against development and destruction. But now the new administration, the Trump administration, wants to roll back some of those protections. So could you fill in what exactly the monument is, why it's important in your view to conserve it, and what we might lose if the Trump administration is successful?
So this is one of my most favorite things to talk about, and it was actually science from the New England Aquarium that helped do the feasibility study that allowed the Obama administration to designate this particular site. So it's a good example of how our research informs some of these policy decisions that have been made. So think about, this is 130 miles off Cape Cod. Think of the Serengeti of the sea. Think of a national park in the ocean. It's just a magnificent place, teeming with wildlife, all kinds of breaching animals and whales and sharks and turtles and mountains, underwater mountains, higher than in the White Mountains, canyons larger than the Grand Canyon, and
wow.
It is majestic. So just for the sake of what it is worth protecting. But it's not just good for that and for research. It's also good for, we've got to allow these species the opportunity to do what they do naturally. And there's a lot of science to suggest that spillover effects actually occur when you can protect parts of the ocean from all kinds of extractive activity. So it's good for the fishermen, too. And that's a really important point to make here, certainly in this region.
Well, that's an interesting argument, because there was a legal case, right? You had a federal judge recently toss out a challenge to that designation by groups of fishermen, right, who didn't see it the way you did. So how can you make that case to fishermen's groups and say, you know what, at face value, this may seem like a danger to your business, but we're actually trying to help you in the long run?
Well, the first thing I would caution against is the fishing community is not monolithic. And so there are fishing communities and fishing interests that, who are very, very much aligned and in support of this monument, and they are the overwhelming voice.
Also on the business front, I understand the New England Aquarium has developed a sustainable seafood advisory service, sort of a consulting arm in a way.
Yeah.
You work with seafood restaurants and grocers, so the Gorton's Fishermen in Gloucester. I love those old ads from the 90s, by the way.
Yeah.
Stop and Shop, how to improve the sustainability of your supply chains, basically. Is this really just a sort of a tiny offshoot, or is this a real sort of revenue business stream for the aquarium? Where does it fit into your whole picture?
So it is part of what we call our Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life, which is where we organize and consolidate our conservation science and research. And I think what you're going to be seeing over the next couple of years is the emergence of more what we're calling a blue economy portfolio, which includes blue tech, the things we're doing in the shipping industry around noise that you mentioned before, and things like sustainable seafood. Because we have this trusted reputation in this community of working with fishermen to solve problems in the ocean, we have almost embedded ourselves with some of these institutions to help advise them about the procurement and the procurement decisions they're making around varieties of seafood.
I don't want to – you said that fishermen are not a monolith, and I want to be mindful, too, that the people who might typically align with your values, maybe it's environmentalists and conservationists, they're not a monolith either. And
right.
We hear some of them, for example, complain about aquariums and zoos simply for keeping animals in captivity. And we've seen some of those institutions change the way they do things. I'm thinking of the National Aquarium in Baltimore, for example, is changing its dolphin exhibit, for example. How do you sort of address those concerns? How often do you hear them? And is that something that is on your mind as you look to the future of the New England Aquarium?
It's always on any aquarium's mind, and you have to constantly be asking yourself, is the benefit gained from giving this amazing experience to people who would never otherwise see it greater than the risk in keeping some of these animals in captivity? So that is a question that I think we are obligated to ask all the time. I would say that I have never run across a group of people who are more careful and caring of how we treat our animals. There is so much behind the scenes that no one understands about how we really keep these animals. And many of our animals are rescued, and so they are absolutely in a better place.
People love those penguins, Vicky. They
yes,
want to make sure they're being
do.
Well taken
yeah,
care
they,
of.
Yeah, I can vouch for that.
That's Vicky Spruill, the new president and chief executive of the New England Aquarium. Vicky, thanks, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. It's playoff time for the Patriots. On Sunday at Gillette Stadium, Tom Brady and company will take on the Los Angeles Chargers in their first matchup of the postseason. On the line, an eventual chance for a third straight Super Bowl appearance. And a lot depends on the play of tight end Rob Gronkowski. Statistically, he's coming off his worst regular season. He's not the same Gronk, the dominant player the Patriots fans have come to know and love. The game has worn him down. WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer looks at how the NFL grind and injuries affect players.
Rob Gronkowski has made a career of dramatic catches. At his best, he's a blur of speed, power, and enviable size. But this season, it's been different. Perhaps his most memorable play came on defense. The Patriots were in Miami moments away from another win when this happened.
Miami running around, circling. Oh, look out! Gronkowski didn't have the angle! Touchdown! Oh, Kenyon Drake! A miracle!
Yes, Rob Gronkowski wasn't in a great position to stop Miami's miraculous game-winning touchdown. He almost never plays defense. But when you watch the replay, this is what really stands out. Gronkowski stumbles going after Drake. He looks old and slow. At the last moment, he makes an awkward dive at the goal line. He never had a chance.
They changed up a little bit, and it sucky.
Fair or not, Gronkowski struggling on defense has come to symbolize his physical decline. 9 injury-riddled NFL seasons have taken a toll. From playing through an ankle sprain in the Super Bowl, to a forearm fracture, to back surgeries, to an ACL tear, to concussions. The list goes on, and it all adds up. But Gronkowski is not unique among NFL players. The brutal nature of the game ages players at an alarming rate and leaves many with lifelong physical damage.
I always say, you age in dog years as a player.
Former NFL linebacker Isaiah Kazavinsky played for 7 seasons, helping the Seattle Seahawks reach Super Bowl 40.
Everybody sees game day, but the amount of time put in the offseason and the practices leading up to the game over long periods of time is just a massive wear and tear on joints, body in general.
Kazavinsky remembers how he'd ride a high from the game on Sunday. Then, Monday morning, he'd find it difficult to get out of bed. At 41, he's now a Boston-based venture capitalist looking at 2 knee replacements. When you ask current NFL players how they feel the morning after games, they often say it's like they've been in a car wreck. They're stiff and every joint in their body aches, but they have to get back to work.
You just got in a car accident. Now, you're not just getting back into a car. You're getting back in a car that's going to go have another accident.
That's Hall of Fame NFL broadcaster Andrea Kramer.
So you know how you're going to feel. And you have to be in a position where you're mentally strong enough to just overcome it.
Over 35 years covering the league, she's talked to dozens of players about the physical toll the game takes. For one story, she got running back Jerome Bettis to mount a camera inside his bedroom.
When he woke up and got out of bed the day after a game, it was literally like he was a 100-year-old man trying to move his body. And to get up just to walk to the bathroom and then coming down the stairs, it was brutal.
And it's not something the players like to discuss, at least not when they're still in the game. Earlier this season, after he returned from a back injury, Gronk was asked how his body responded to playing in a game for the first time in almost 4 weeks.
Good. I feel good. I mean, you know, the football wear and tear and all that. I mean, you're never going to leave a game and be like, ah.
That's his way of saying you're never going to leave the game feeling great. It's the same for every NFL player.
It's just a young man's game. It's a fast man's game, and it's a healthy man's game. And once you start to fall out of that, then they start to look not like the stars they were before, and their careers start to end.
That's the Houston Texans team doctor, Walter Lowe.
Gronk is the same as a bunch of big guys. When you've had back issues, when you've had medical issues that affect the ability to play, pretty soon you're not yourself. And when you're not yourself in that league, there's somebody good standing right behind you to take your place.
On Sunday, Gronkowski will be back at tight end. And for better or worse, he'll be judged against the player he used to be.
That report from WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. And with us now to talk more about Sunday's game is Boston Globe NFL reporter Ben Volen. Ben, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Callum, thanks for having me today.
All right, so we just heard Shira's report there about Gronk, his injuries, his decline. Historically, he's played his best football in the postseason, but can we expect him to step up in the same way this time around?
I think it's a tough ask to have Rob Gronkowski be able to kind of snap his fingers and turn into the old player. I'm not saying it can't happen. He's had some good games this year. Last month in Miami, the game that Shira was referencing where he couldn't make the final play, he did have 8 catches for over 100 yards and a touchdown that game. He's had some good games this year. He still makes a lot of catches and is good in the run game, a good all-around player, but he's not the same dominant player we're used to seeing. He's been dealing with ankle and back injuries all season, and I think it's, as Shira said, an accumulation of a lot of injuries and a lot of hits over 9 years of football. And, you know, let's not forget, you're playing a pretty good team this time of year, too. You're playing the L.A. Chargers, who have an excellent defense, and one player in specific, Derwin James, they're all-pro rookie. He's probably going to see Rob Gronkowski a lot. So I think Rob will be part of the game plan, but I'm not expecting him to be the same dominant Gronk that we remember.
And if we think about injuries as a whole, as Shira was sort of broadening out that conversation, I'm very much reminded of Philip Rivers playing the AFC Championship game against the Patriots a decade ago on a torn ACL. I can remember Ben giving a major tough guy points for that. I was very impressed, and now I'm beginning to think about things a little bit differently. Also, I was watching old tape. Junior Seau is in that game. I mean, fans are feeling conflicted these days, aren't they?
Yeah, it's been 11 years since the Chargers and Patriots last played in the playoffs. It was that AFC Championship game in January of 2008. And as you said, Philip Rivers, who's not the most mobile quarterback, it's not like he runs around too much, but he played through a torn ACL, which was incredibly tough and earned a lot of respect. This is a guy who hasn't really won anything over 13 years, but I say most impressively is his durability and toughness. He's played 208 regular season games and 10 playoff games. He started every single one of them, has never missed a start since taking over in 2006, which in today's NFL, with all the hits you're taking, it's very tough. And even this year's team, the Chargers, have gone on the road and won in some very tough places, at Seattle, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, London. They've won in five different time zones. Anytime they get on a plane, they've won this year. The only time they lost was also in Los Angeles to the Rams. So the Patriots, you know, sometimes they get an opponent in this divisional round game that isn't quite worthy, and the Patriots can kind of breeze through and look ahead to the AFC Championship game. Not this time. The Chargers are going to give them all they can handle on Sunday.
And the Chargers had to beat Baltimore and that very good Ravens defense to get here last week. And after that win, Philip Rivers was asked about this rematch. We just talked about the backdrop with that torn ACL 11 years ago. This is his chance at redemption, and he's not shying away from the rivalry.
But is it special to go to New England against a Hall of Fame coach and arguably the best quarterback ever to play and get another shot at him? Heck yeah. Heck yeah, it is. It is special.
It's kind of refreshing, isn't it, Ben? I mean, we hear so often from it's just one more game. It's just one more game. That's not what we're hearing from Philip Rivers.
No, he's fantastic. He's a media's dream, and selfishly, you like to see guys like him do well because you keep getting great quotes, and he says a lot of dad gums and aw shoots. He's a very folksy, genuine kind of guy. It's great to see him admit that, of course, when you play the Patriots, the AFC goes through this team, especially the last 4 or 5 years, and it is extra special to play the Patriots. And if Philip Rivers can pull this off, it'd be quite an accomplishment for him. He's 0-7 in his career against Tom Brady. Has never beaten him over all these years, never obviously in the playoffs, never in the regular season. Philip Rivers has only played in one AFC Championship game. That was that game 11 years ago that we mentioned. He's 37 years old. His career, you know, the clock is ticking. He understands that there might not be so many great chances left. And the way the Chargers are playing this year, this could be his one chance to finally make it to that Super Bowl.
Well, if Philip Rivers is the media's dream, Bill Belichick might be the opposite. And I understand you're just arriving here from a Bill Belichick news conference. What did he have to say, if anything?
He was trying to downplay a lot of the, I'd say, intangible factors that play in the Patriots' favor. He was asked about having home field advantage and how important is that, and he tried to downplay and say, I don't think there's no home field advantage. Last week, 3 out of the 4 road teams won, and he's right about that point. The road teams did win, but there's definitely a home field advantage overall in the NFL. I think this regular season, the home teams won 59% of the games, and when you get up to the postseason, it turns into about 70%, somewhere along those lines. And the Patriots especially, they need that home field advantage. They were a Jekyll and Hyde team this year, 8-0 at home, unbeatable, beat some very good teams, and just 3-5 on the road. Did not play well on the road and lost to some very mediocre teams. So I think playing this game in Foxborough is a big advantage for the Patriots. Coming off a bye, they'll be well rested. They just have to make sure that they have the right energy and they're ready to go on Sunday, coming off that extra week of rest.
It's been, to say the least, an up and down season for these Patriots. They've lost some games that we did not expect them to lose. That game in Tennessee, that awful ending in Miami, but they are undefeated at home, and they seem, Ben, to have this ability to just flip a switch when it comes to playoff time. Should we expect that to happen this weekend, or are you a little bit worried?
Well, I'm worried because the Chargers are a very good team, and I think if you look at the matchup on paper, on both sides of the football, I think the Chargers check most of the boxes, but the Patriots have the intangibles in their factor. It will be a home game where they're 8-0. It will be very cold. The Chargers are not used to playing these cold games. The Chargers, this will be their second cross-country trip in 8 days. And that's a long flight from Los Angeles to Boston. And I know they're getting here on Friday and they'll have time to acclimate, but that's still, I don't know how big of a factor, but it's certainly a factor. So the Patriots, they'll have to be on top of their game against the Chargers. I think they will pull it out, but yeah, this is a game where the Patriots really need to be on their P's and Q's, and the Chargers are going to test them for a full 60 minutes.
And as Ben mentioned, Philip Rivers is 37. Tom Brady is 41. So here's your bit of trivia for the week. They will be the oldest combined quarterbacks at 78 total years to face off in a playoff game. Boston Globe reporter Ben Volen, thanks so much for being here on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.